restored. And the third passed by an overwhelming vote of 175-42, called for the establishment of a special committee of Congress to investigate whether the bank had deliberately instigated the current economic crisis. It was an overwhelming victory for Jackson, which would be culminated a few years later with the passage of a resolution in the Senate, which formally rescinded the previous vote of censure. Biddle defies Congress. When the investigating committee arrived at the bank's doors in Philadelphia armed with a subpoena to examine the books, Biddle flatly refused. Nor would he allow inspection of the correspondence with congressmen relating to their personal loans and advances, and he steadfastly refused to testify before the committee back in Washington. For lesser mortals, such action would have resulted in citations of contempt of Congress and would have carried stiff fines or imprisonment. But not for Nicholas Biddle. Rimini explains, "The committeemen demanded a citation for contempt, but many Southern Democrats opposed this extreme action and refused to cooperate. As Biddle bemusedly observed, it would be ironic if he went to prison by the votes of members of Congress because I would not give up to their enemies their confidential letters." Although Biddle escaped a contempt citation, his outrageous defiance of the House only condemned him still further in the eyes of the American public. The bank was still alive, but had been mortally wounded. By this time, Jackson had completely paid off the national debt incurred by the War of 1812, and had even run up a surplus. In fact, he ordered the Treasury to give back to the states more than $35 million, which was used for the construction of a wide variety of public works. With these accomplishments close on the heels of his victory over the bank, the president had earned the undying hatred of monetary scientists, both in America and abroad. It is not surprising, therefore, that on January 30, 1835, an assassination attempt was made against him. Miraculously, both pistols of the assailant misfired, and Jackson was spared by a quirk of fate. It was the first such attempt to be made against the life of a president of the United States. The would-be assassin was Richard Lawrence, who either was truly insane or who pretended to be insane to escape harsh punishment. At any rate, Lawrence was found not guilty due to insanity. Later, he boasted to friends that he had been in touch with powerful people in Europe who had promised to protect him from punishment should he be caught. The ending to this saga holds no surprises. The bank's charter expired in 1836, and it was restructured as a state bank by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. After a spree of speculation in cotton, lavish advances to the bank's officers, and the suspension of payment in specie, Biddle was arrested and charged with fraud. Although not convicted, he was still undergoing civil litigation when he died. Within 5 years, the establishment was forced to close its doors forever, and America's third experience with central banking came to a close. Some bad mixed in with the good. It is tempting to let the story stop right there and allow Jackson to forever wear the crown of hero and dragon slayer. But a more balanced view of these events leads to the conclusion that the forces of virtue were not without contamination. Jackson represented the position of those who wanted only gold and silver for the nation's money. But this group was not large enough to match the power of the bank. He was joined in that battle by many groups which hated the bank for other, less admirable reasons. State banks and business interests along the expanding frontier, for example, were not the least interested in constitutional money. They wanted just the opposite. They viewed the modest restraints of the Federal Bank as excessive. With the Federal Bank out of the way, they anticipated no restraints at all. As we shall see in the following section, it is ironic that this is the group that got what it wanted, not the hard-money Jacksonians. One cannot blame Jackson for accepting the support of these groups in his effort to slay the dragon. In politics, it often is necessary to make temporary alliances with one's opponents to achieve occasional common objectives. But Jackson went further than that. More than any other president before him, and rivaled by only a few since, he changed the character of American politics. He led the nation away from the new concept of diffused powers, carefully worked out by the founding fathers, back toward the old-world tradition of concentration and monarchy. By strongly challenging the right of the states to secede from the Union, he set into motion a concept that not only would lead to civil war, but which would put an end forever to the ability of the states to check the expanding power of the federal government. No longer was the Union to be based on the principle of consent of the governed. It was now to be based on force of arms. And through the manipulation of voter passion on the bank issue, he changed the perception of the role of president from public servant to national leader. At the height of the battle against the bank, when Jackson was making a direct appeal to the voters for support, he declared, "The president is the direct representative of the people." To fully comprehend the significance of that statement, it must be remembered that the plan of the Constitution was for the president to be elected indirectly by the state legislatures, not by the voters at large. After fighting a war to throw off the rule of King George III, the Founding Fathers wanted nothing more to do with kings of any kind, and they went out of their way to make sure that the President of the United States would never be looked upon as such. They realized that an elected ruler, unless his power is carefully limited and diffused, can become just as despotic as an unelected one. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, therefore, established an electoral college to select the president. Members of the college are to be appointed by the states. Congressmen, senators, or other officers of the federal government are specifically and wisely excluded. The college is supposed to select a president strictly on the basis of his integrity and executive ability, not his party label, political connections, good looks, charisma, or stirring orations. The people may elect their congressman, but the electoral college chooses the president. Thus, it was intended that the president would have a different constituency from Congress, and this difference was important to ensure the balance of power that the framers of the Constitution worked so hard to create. As a means of keeping government under control, it was a truly brilliant piece of political engineering. All of that was changed in the election of 1832. One of the sad facts of history is that good causes often are the occasion for establishing bad precedents. Jackson's fight against the Bank of the United States was one of those events. Summary. The government had encouraged widespread banking fraud during the War of 1812 as an expedient for paying its bills, and this had left the nation in monetary chaos. At the end of the war, instead of allowing the fraudulent banks to fall and letting the free market heal the damage, Congress decided to protect the banks, to organize the fraud, and to perpetuate the losses. It did this by creating the nation's third central bank, called the Second Bank of the United States. The new bank was almost an exact carbon copy of the previous one. It was authorized to create money for the federal government and to regulate state banks. It influenced larger amounts of capital and was better organized across state lines than the old bank. Consequently, its policies had a greater impact on the creation and extinguishing of the nation's money supply. For the first time in our history, the effects began to ricochet across the entire country at once, instead of being confined to geographical regions. The age of the boom-bust cycle had at last arrived in America. In 1820, public opinion began to swing back in favor of the sound money principles espoused by the Jeffersonian Republicans. But since the Republican Party had by then abandoned those principles, a new coalition was formed, headed by Martin Van Buren and Andrew Jackson, called the Democrat Party. One of its primary platforms was the abolishment of the bank. After Jackson was elected in 1828, he began in full earnest to bring that about. The head of the bank was a formidable adversary by the name of Nicholas Biddle. Biddle not only possessed great personal abilities, but many members of Congress were indebted to him for business favors. Consequently, the bank had many political friends. As Jackson's first term of office neared its end, Biddle asked Congress for an early renewal of the bank's charter, hoping that Jackson would not risk controversy in a re-election year. The bill was easily passed, but Jackson accepted the challenge and vetoed the measure. Thus, a battle over the bank's future became the primary presidential campaign issue. Jackson was re-elected by a large margin, and one of his first acts was to remove federal deposits from the bank and place them into private, regional banks. Biddle counterattacked by contracting credit and calling in loans. This was calculated to shrink the money supply and trigger a national panic depression, which it did. He publicly blamed the downturn on Jackson's removal of deposits. The plan almost worked. Biddle's political allies succeeded in having Jackson officially censured in the Senate. However, when the truth about Biddle's strategy finally leaked out, it backfired against him. He was called before a special congressional investigative committee to explain his actions. The censure against Jackson was rescinded, and the nation's third central bank passed into oblivion. Chapter 18. Loaves and Fishes and Civil War. Attempts to stabilize the banking system by political measures, including regulation of fractional reserve ratios and establishing bank failure insurance funds. The failure of all such schemes. The resulting economic conditions that led up to the Civil War. As detailed in the previous chapter, by 1836, the Hydra-headed monster had been slain, and, true to the president's campaign promise, the nation had Jackson and no bank. In April of that year, the administration moved to consolidate its victory and pushed a series of monetary reforms through Congress. One of these required all banks to cease issuing paper notes under $5. The figure later was increased to $20, and its purpose was to compel the nation to return to the use of gold and silver coin for everyday use, leaving banknotes primarily for large commercial transactions. The White House also announced that, in the future, all federal land sales would require full payment in lawful money, which of course meant precious metal coins. It must be remembered, however, that even though the Bank of the United States was dead, banking was very much alive, and so were Jackson's enemies. Much to the disappointment of the hard money advocates, these measures were not sufficient to usher in the millennium. Not only were they inadequate by themselves, they were soon circumvented by the development of new banking techniques, and eventually were dismantled completely by a fickle Congress. The prohibition against banknotes of small denomination deserves special notice. It was an excellent concept, but what the legislators failed to understand, or at least pretended not to understand, was that banks at this time were increasingly dealing with checkbook money, technically called demand deposits. As people gradually became accustomed to this new method of transferring funds, the importance of banknotes declined, placing a limit on the issuance of banknotes without any restriction on the creation of demand deposits was an exercise in futility. In 1837, as the Bank of the United States slipped into history, the nation was at the tail end of an economic boom. Professor Rothbard tells us that this expansion and the accompanying inflation had been fueled by the central bank. Total money in circulation had risen by 84% in just 4 years. Then, as inevitable as the setting sun, that portion of the money supply which had been created by fractional reserve banking, in other words, the part which was backed by nothing, began to contract. 16% of all the nation's money totally disappeared in just that first year. Again, men were put out of work, businesses went into bankruptcy, homes and savings were lost. Many banks folded also, but their operators walked away with the spoils. Only the depositors were left holding the empty bag. There were numerous proposals advanced regarding how to infuse stability into the banking system, but then, as now, none of them dealt with the real problem, which was fractional reserve banking itself. As Grosclose observed, these proposals were each according to a particular theory of how to multiply loaves and fishes, or how to make candy wool. Since the proposals presented then are identical to the ones being offered today, and since each of them was actually tried, it would seem appropriate to inquire into the actual results of these experiments. Proposal to base money on bank assets. There were four schools of thought regarding the multiplication of loaves and fishes. The first of these was that the creation of money should be limited to a ratio of the bank's assets. This was the formula that was tried in the New England states. In Massachusetts, for example, the issuance of banknotes was limited to 2 times the amount of the bank's capital actually held in the vault. Furthermore, this could not be in the form of paper money, bonds, securities, or other debt instruments. It had to be strictly gold or silver coin. Also, the banks were limited in the number of small denomination banknotes they could issue, and in this, Massachusetts served as the model for Jackson's attempted reform at the federal level. By previous standards, and certainly by the standards that prevail today, this was an exceptionally conservative policy. In fact, even during the previous stress of the War of 1812, when banks were failing by the hundreds across the country, the Massachusetts banks, and most of the other New England banks as well, were able to maintain full payment in specie. With the passage of time, however, the limit on banknotes became less important because the banks now were using checkbook money instead. Their paper notes may have been limited to 200% of their capital, but there was no effective limit to the numbers they could ink into people's deposit books. So the fraction in fractional reserve banking began to shrink again. Consequently, the monetary contraction of 1837 was like a scythe over the crop, says Grosclose, and 32 Massachusetts banks collapsed between that year and 1844. The state attempted to patch the system by instituting a network of bank examiners and by increasing the liability of bank stockholders for the lost funds of their depositors, but the underlying problem was still ignored. A new crop of banks then sprang into existence, and a new wave of speculative mania swept through the economy. By 1862, even though the law still limited banknotes to 2 times capital, the banks had created $73,685,000 in total money, including checkbook money. This was supported by a base of only $9,595,000 of specie, a reserve of only 13%. Massachusetts had not solved the problem. Proposal to protect deposits with a safety fund. The second theory about how to have stable banking and allow the banks to create money out of nothing was to create a safety fund. This fund, supported by all the banks, would come to the aid of any member which needed an emergency loan to cover a sudden drain on its reserves. It was the forerunner of today's Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and related agencies. The first safety fund was established in New York in 1829. The law required each bank to contribute annually 0.5% of its capital stock until the total reached 3%. The fund was first put to the test during the crisis of 1837 and was almost swamped. The only thing that saved it was that the state agreed to accept the worthless notes of all the defunct banks as payment for canal tolls. In other words, the taxpayers were compelled to make up the difference. When the fund was exhausted, the solvent banks were punished by being forced to pay for the deficits of the insolvent ones. Naturally, this impelled all banks to act more recklessly. Why not? The upside was that profits would be higher, for a time at least, and the downside was that if recklessness got them into trouble, the safety fund would bail them out. The result was that the system provided a penalty for prudence and an incentive for recklessness, a situation with perfect parallel to that which exists in the banking system today. Grosclose says, "The conservatively managed institutions, lending upon the safer risks, upon which naturally the margins of profit were smaller, found the assessments burdensome and were compelled to embark upon the more speculative business in order to carry the charges. Gradually, all banks sank into the quagmire, and in 1857 the Massachusetts Safety Fund was abandoned. Michigan's experience with a safety fund was perhaps more typical of the period. It was established in 1836 and was completely blown away the next year, during the Panic of 1837. Proposal to base money on securities. The third proposal for maintaining a stable monetary system, while at the same time allowing the banks to operate fraudulently, was to base the money supply on government securities, in other words, upon paper certificates of government debt. This was the scheme adopted in the 1850s by Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, and other Midwestern states. It also set the precedent for the Federal Reserve System 60 years later. Grossclose continues, "So rampant was the note-issue mania that the notes came to be called by the appropriate name of red dog and wildcat currency. The rising crop of banks created a fictitious demand and a rising market for securities, to be used as capital stock, and a consequent stimulus to the creation of public debt by the issue of securities. This was followed by more banknotes being issued against the securities, demand increasing and the market rising, more securities issues, more banknotes, and so on in an endless chain of debt creation and the inflation of paper wealth. The process was finally brought to a stop by the Panic of 1857. Proposal to back money with state credit. The fourth proposal for producing something out of nothing was to back the issuance of money by the full faith and credit of the state. This was the method tried by many of the southern states, and it too has survived to become one of the cornerstones of our modern-day banking system. Alabama, for example, in 1835, created a state bank funded by a public bond issue of $13,800,000. Instant money flooded through the economy, and people were joyous over the miracle prosperity. The legislators were so intoxicated with the scheme that they completely abolished direct taxation and decided to run the government on bank money instead. In other words, instead of raising state revenue through taxes, they found it easier to raise it through inflation. Like all the others, this bubble also burst in the Panic of 1837. A post-mortem examination of the bank showed that $6 million of its assets were completely worthless. The people who had lent their real money to the venture, backed by the full faith and credit of the state, lost almost all of their investment, in addition to what they had paid through inflation. Mississippi put its full faith and credit behind a state bank in 1838 and issued $15 million in bonds as backing for its banknotes. The bank was belly up within 4 years, and the state completely repudiated its obligations on the bonds. This infuriated the bondholders, particularly the British financiers, who had purchased a large portion of the issue. The devastating effect upon the state and its people is described by Henry Poor. The $48 million of the bank's loans were never paid. The $23 million of notes and deposits were never redeemed. The whole system fell, a huge and shapeless wreck, leaving the people of the state very much as they came into the world. Everybody was in debt without any possible means of payment. Lands became worthless for the reason that no one had any money to pay for them. Such numbers of people fled from the state that the common return upon legal processes against debtors was in the very abbreviated form GTT, gone to Texas. Money, based on the full faith and credit of the state, met similar fates in Illinois, Kentucky, Florida, Tennessee, and Louisiana. When the state bank collapsed in Illinois in 1825, all of the full faith banknotes left in its possession were ceremoniously burned at the public square. Another bank was formed in 1835 that collapsed in 1842. So devastating were these experiences that the Illinois Constitution of 1848 stipulated that henceforth the state should never again create a bank or own banking stock. In Arkansas, even real estate was tried as a magic wand. Subscribers to the state bank, instead of putting up cash, were allowed merely to pledge their real estate holdings as collateral. The banknotes rapidly plummeted in value to only 25% of their face amount, and within 4 years, the bank was gone. The mirage of free banking. There was a parallel development at this time called free banking. The name is an insult to truth. What was called free banking was merely the conversion of banks from corporations to private associations. Aside from no longer receiving a charter from the state, practically every other aspect of the system remained the same, including a multitude of government controls, regulations, supports, and other blocks against the free market. George Selgin reminds us that permission to set up a bank was usually accompanied by numerous restrictions, including especially required loans to the state. The free banks were no less fraudulent than the chartered banks. The old custom was revived of rushing gold coins from one bank to another just ahead of the bank examiners, and of putting a ballast of lead, broken glass, and, appropriately, tenpenny nails in the box under a thinner covering of gold coins. When one such free bank collapsed in Massachusetts, it was discovered that its banknote circulation of $500,000 was backed by exactly $86.48. Professor Hans Senholz writes, "Although economists disagree on many things, most see eye to eye on their acceptance of political control. These economists invariably point at American money and banking before the Civil War, which in their judgment confirms their belief. In particular, they cite the free banking era of 1838 to 1860 as a frightening example of turbulent banking and, therefore, applaud the legislation that strengthened the role of government. In reality, the instability experienced during the free banking era was not caused by anything inherent in banking, but resulted from extensive political intervention. Free banking acts did not repeal burdensome statutory provisions and regulatory directives. In fact, they added a few. For banking to have been truly free, the states would have had to do only two things. One, enforce banking contracts the same as any other contract, and then, two, step out of the picture. By enforcing banking contracts, the executives of any bank which failed to redeem its currency in specie would have been sent to prison, an eventuality which soon would have put a halt to currency overissue. By stepping out of the picture and dropping the pretense of protecting the public with a barrage of rules, regulations, safety funds, and guarantees, people would have realized that it was their responsibility to be cautious and informed. But instead, the banks continued to enjoy the special privilege of suspending payment without punishment, and the politicians clamored to convince the voters that they were taking care of everything. In short, throughout this entire period of bank failures, economic chaos, and fleecing of both investors and taxpayers, America tried everything except full redemption by gold and silver. As the name of Andrew Jackson faded into history, so did the dream of honest banking. Not all banks were corrupt, and certainly not all bankers were conspirators against the public. There were many examples of honest men striving to act in an ethical manner in the discharge of their fiduciary responsibilities. But they were severely hampered by the system within which they labored, a system which, as previously illustrated, punished prudence and rewarded recklessness. In balance, the prudent banker was pushed aside by the mainstream and became but a footnote to the history of that period. Industrial expansion in spite of dishonest banking. Another positive aspect to the picture is that it was during this same time that many business enterprises came into being and greatly prospered, albeit at the expense of those who had no desire to contribute. The great canals were dug. The railroads pushed back the frontier. Boom towns sprang up along the way. Prairies were turned into agricultural land, and new businesses followed in their wake. Much of this expansion was facilitated by a flood of fraudulent money created by the banks. Apologists for fractional reserve banking have been prone to look at this development and conclude that, in net balance, it was a good thing. The fact that some people were cheated in order for others to prosper did not seem to be important. America just wouldn't have grown and prospered without funny money. Galbraith, for example, exudes, "As civilization, or some approximation, came to an Indiana or Michigan crossroads in the 1830s or 1840s, so did a bank. Its notes, when used and loaned to a farmer to buy land, livestock, feed, seed, food, or simple equipment, put him into business. If he and others prospered and paid off their loans, the bank survived. If he and others did not so prosper and pay, the bank failed, and someone, perhaps a local creditor, perhaps an eastern supplier, was left holding the worthless notes. But some borrowers from this bank were by now in business. Somewhere, someone holding the notes had made an involuntary contribution to the winning of the West. The banking anarchy served the frontier far better than a more orderly system that kept a tight hand on credit could have done." William Grider continues this rationale. "Reckless, booming anarchy, in short, produced fundamental progress. It was not a stable system, racked as it was with bank failures and collapsed business ventures, outrageous speculation and defaulted loans. Yet it was also energetic and inventive, creating permanent economic growth that endured after the froth had been blown away." This, of course, is a classic example of the failure of liberal economics. When evaluating a policy, it focuses only on one beneficial consequence for one group of people and ignores the multitude of harmful effects which befall all other groups. Yes, if we look only at the frontiersmen who acquired new ranches and established new business, the fractional reserve system looks pretty good. But if we add into the equation all the financial losses to all of the people who were victimized by the system, what Galbraith calls an involuntary contribution, and what Grider lightly dismisses as froth, then the product is zero at best, and in terms of morality, is deeply in the negative. Galbraith, Grider, and other popular economists assume that the West could not possibly have been won with honest banking. Logic does not support such a conclusion. There is every reason to believe that the bank failures and the resulting business failures on the frontier all but canceled out the gains that were made by hard work and honest industry. Had these destructive convulsions been absent, as most of them would have been under a less chaotic system, there likely would have been fewer business starts, but a greater number would have finished, and it is entirely possible that the West would have been won even faster than it was. It's too bad the theory has never been tried. The Union in Jeopardy. As chronicled in a previous section, economic conflict has always played a major role in fomenting war. There is no time in American history in which there was more economic conflict between segments of the population than there was prior to the Civil War. It is not surprising, therefore, that this period led directly into the nation's bloodiest war, made all the more tragic because it pitted brother against brother. There are many popular myths about the cause of the war between the states. Just as the Bolshevik Revolution is commonly believed to have been a spontaneous mass uprising against a tyrannical aristocracy, so too it is generally accepted that the Civil War was fought over the issue of slavery. That, at best, is a half-truth. Slavery was an issue, but the primary force for war was a clash between the economic interests of the North and the South. Even the issue of slavery itself was based on economics. It may have been a moral issue in the North, where prosperity was derived from the machines of heavy industry, but in the agrarian South, where fields had to be tended by vast workforces of human labor, the issue was primarily a matter of economics. The relative unimportance of slavery as a cause for war was made clear by Lincoln himself during his campaign for the presidency in 1860, and he repeated that message in his first inaugural address. Apprehension seems to exist among the people of the southern states that by the accession of a Republican administration, their property and their peace and personal security are to be endangered. I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it now exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so. Even after the outbreak of war in 1861, Lincoln confirmed his previous stand. He declared, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could do it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." It may come as a surprise to learn that, by strict definition, Abraham Lincoln was a white supremacist. In his fourth debate with Senator Stephen Douglas, he addressed the subject bluntly. "I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior, and I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." This is not to say that Lincoln was indifferent to the institution of slavery, for he felt strongly that it was a violation of personal and national morality, but he also knew that slavery was gradually being swept away all over the world, with the possible exception of Africa itself, and he believed that it would soon disappear in America simply by allowing the natural forces of enlightenment to work their way through the political system. He feared, and rightly so, that to demand immediate and total reform not only would destroy the Union, it would lead to massive bloodshed and more human suffering than was endured even under slavery itself. He said, "I have not allowed myself to forget that the abolition of the slave trade by Great Britain was agitated 100 years before it was a final success, that the measure had its open, fire-eating opponents, its stealthy, don't-care opponents, its dollar-and-cent opponents, its inferior race opponents, its Negro equality opponents, and its religion and good order opponents, that all these opponents got offices and their adversaries got none. But I have also remembered that, though they blazed like tallow candles for a century, at last they flickered in the socket, died out, stank in the dark for a brief season, and were remembered no more, even by the smell. Schoolboys know that Wilberforce and Granville Sharp helped that cause forward, but who can now name a single man who labored to retard it? Remembering these things, I cannot but regard it as possible that the higher object of this contest may not be completely attained within the term of my natural life." If Lincoln's primary goal in the war was not the abolition of slavery, but simply to preserve the Union, the question arises, why did the Union need preserving? Or, more pointedly, why did the Southern states want to secede?
You have reached the end of Disc 13.
Legal plunder, not slavery, the cause of war. The South, being predominantly an agricultural region, had to import practically all of its manufactured goods from the northern states or from Europe, both of which reciprocated by providing a market for the South's cotton. However, many of the textiles and manufactured items were considerably cheaper from Europe, even after the cost of shipping had been added. The southern states therefore often found it to their advantage to purchase these European goods rather than those made in the north. This put considerable competitive pressure on the American manufacturers to lower their prices and operate more efficiently. The Republicans were not satisfied with that arrangement. They decided to use the power of the federal government to tip the scales of competition in their favor. Claiming that this was in the national interest, they levied stiff import duties on almost every item coming from Europe that was also manufactured in the North. Not surprisingly, there was no duty applied to cotton, which presumably was not a commodity in the national interest. One result was that European countries countered by stopping the purchase of U.S. cotton, which badly hurt the southern economy. The other result was that manufacturers in the North were able to charge higher prices without fear of competition, and the South was forced to pay more for practically all of its necessities. It was a classic case of legalized plunder, in which the law was used to enrich one group of citizens at the expense of another. Pressure from the North against slavery in the South made matters even more volatile. A fact often overlooked in this episode is that the cost of a slave was very high, around $1,500 each. A modest plantation with only 40 or 50 slaves, therefore, had a large capital investment, which in terms of today's purchasing power represented many millions of dollars. To the South, therefore, abolition meant not only the loss of its ability to produce a cash crop, but the total destruction of an enormous capital base. Many southern plantation owners were working toward the day when they could convert their investment to more profitable industrial production, as had been done in the north, and others felt that free men who were paid wages would be more efficient than slaves who had no incentive to work. For the present, however, they were stuck with the system they inherited. They felt that a complete and sudden abolition of slavery with no transition period would destroy their economy and leave many of the former slaves to starve, all of which actually happened in due course. That was the situation that existed at the time of Lincoln's campaign, and why, in his speeches, he attempted to calm the fears of the South about his intentions. But his words were mostly political rhetoric. Lincoln was a Republican, and he was totally dependent on the Northern industrialists who controlled the party. Even if he had wanted to, and there is no indication that he did, he could not have reversed the trend of economic favoritism and protectionism that swept him into office. Mexico and the Monroe Doctrine. In addition to the conflicting interests between the North and South, there were other forces also working to split the nation in two. Those forces were rooted in Europe and centered around the desire of France, Spain, and England to control the markets of Latin America. Mexico was the prime target. This was the reason the Monroe Doctrine had been formulated 38 years previously. President James Monroe had put the European nations on notice that the United States would not interfere in their affairs and that any interference by them in American affairs would not be tolerated. In particular, the proclamation said that the American continents were no longer to be considered as available for colonization. None of the European powers wanted to put this issue to the test, but they knew that if the United States were to become embroiled in a civil war, it could not also cross swords in Latin America. To encourage war between the states, therefore, was to pave the way for colonial expansion in Mexico. The Americas had become a giant chessboard for the game of global politics. In the American Heritage Picture History of the Civil War, we read, "The war had not progressed very far before it was clear that the ruling classes in each of these two countries, England and France, sympathized strongly with the Confederacy, so strongly that with just a little prodding they might be moved to intervene and bring about southern independence by force of arms. Europe's aristocracies had never been happy about the prodigious success of the Yankee democracy. If the nation now broke into halves, proving that democracy did not contain the stuff of survival, the rulers of Europe would be well pleased." The global chess match between Lincoln on the one side and England and France on the other was closely watched by the other leaders of Europe. One of the most candid observers at that time was the Chancellor of Germany, Otto von Bismarck. Since Bismarck was himself deeply obligated to the power of international finance, his observations are doubly revealing. He said, "The division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained in one bloc and as one nation, would attain economic and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over Europe and the world." Of course, in the inner circle of finance, the voice of the Rothschilds prevailed. They saw an opportunity for prodigious booty if they could substitute two feeble democracies burdened with debt to the financiers in place of a vigorous republic sufficient unto herself. Therefore, they sent their emissaries into the field to exploit the question of slavery and to drive a wedge between the two parts of the Union. The rupture between the North and the South became inevitable. The masters of European finance employed all their forces to bring it about and to turn it to their advantage. The strategy was simple but effective. Within months after the first clash of arms between North and South, France had landed troops in Mexico. By 1864, the Mexicans were subdued, and the French monarch installed Ferdinand Maximilian as the puppet emperor. The Confederacy found a natural ally in Maximilian, and it was anticipated by both groups that, after the successful execution of the war, they would combine into a new nation, dominated by the financial power of Rothschild, of course. At the same time, England moved 11,000 troops into Canada, positioned them menacingly along the Union's northern flank, and placed the British fleet onto wartime alert. The European powers were closing in for a checkmate. Summary. The Second Bank of the United States was dead, but banking was very much alive. Many of the old problems continued, and new ones arrived. The issuance of banknotes had been severely limited, but that was largely offset by the increasing use of checkbook money, which had no limits at all on its issue. When the Second Bank of the U.S. slipped into history, the nation was nearing the end of the boom phase of a boom-bust cycle. When the inevitable contraction of the money supply came, politicians began to offer proposals on how to infuse stability into the banking system. None dealt with the real problem, which was fractional reserve banking itself. They concentrated instead on proposals on how to make it work. All of these proposals were tried, and they failed. These years are sometimes described as a period of free banking, which is an insult to truth. All that happened was that banks were converted from corporations to private associations, a change in form, not substance. They continued to be burdened by government controls, regulations, supports, and other blocks against the free market. The economic chaos and conflict of this period was a major cause of the Civil War. Lincoln made it clear during his public speeches that slavery was not the issue. The basic problem was that North and South were dependent on each other for trade. The industrialized North sold its products to the South, which sold its cotton to the North. The South also had a similar trade with Europe, and that was an annoyance to the North. Europe was selling many products at lower prices, and the North was losing market share. Northern politicians passed protectionist legislation, putting import duties on industrial products. This all but stopped the importation of European goods and forced the South to buy from the North at higher prices. Europe retaliated by curtailing the purchase of American cotton. That hurt the South even more. It was a classic case of legalized plunder, and the South wanted out. Meanwhile, there were powerful forces in Europe that wanted to see America embroiled in civil war. If she could be split into two hostile countries, there would be less obstacle to European expansion on the North American continent. France was eager to capture Mexico and graft it onto a new empire, which would include many of the southern states as well. England, on the other hand, had military forces poised along the Canadian border, ready for action. Political agitators, funded and organized from Europe, were active on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. The issue of slavery was but a ploy. America had become the target in a ruthless game of world economics and politics. Chapter 19. Greenbacks and Other Crimes. The causes of the Civil War shown to be economic and political, not the issue of freedom versus slavery. The manner in which both sides used fiat money to finance the war. The important role played by foreign powers. In the previous chapter, we saw how the American continent had become a giant chessboard in a game of global politics. The European powers had been anxious to see the United States become embroiled in a civil war and eventually break into two smaller and weaker nations. That would pave the way for their further colonization of Latin America without fear of the Americans being able to enforce the Monroe Doctrine. And so it was that within a few months after the outbreak of war between North and South, France landed troops in Mexico, and by 1864 had installed Maximilian as her puppet monarch. Negotiations were begun immediately to bring Mexico into the war on the side of the Confederacy. England moved her troops to the Canadian border in a show of strength. America was facing what appeared to be a checkmate from the powers in Europe. Russia aligns with the North. It was a masterful move that possibly could have won the game had not an unexpected event tipped the scale against it. Tsar Alexander II, who incidentally had never allowed a central bank to be established in Russia, notified Lincoln that he stood ready to militarily align with the North. Although the Tsar had recently freed the serfs in his own country, his primary motivation for coming to the aid of the Union undoubtedly had little to do with emancipating the slaves in the South. England and France had been maneuvering to break up the Russian Empire by splitting off Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Crimea, and Georgia. Napoleon III of France proposed to Great Britain and Austria that the three nations immediately declare war on Russia to hasten this dismemberment. Knowing that war was being considered by his enemies, Tsar Alexander decided to play a chess game of his own. In September of 1863, he dispatched his Baltic fleet of warships to Alexandria, Virginia, and his Asiatic fleet to San Francisco. The significance of this move was explained by Russian-born Karl Wrangel Rokossovsky. No treaty was signed between Russia and the United States, but their mutual interests and the threat of war to both unified these two nations at this critical moment. By dispatching his Baltic fleet to the North American harbors, the Tsar changed his position from a defensive to an offensive one. Paragraph 3 of the instructions given to Admiral Lesovsky by Admiral Krabbe, at that time Russian Secretary of the Navy, dated July 14, 1863, ordered the Russian fleet, in case of war, to attack the enemy's commercial shipping and their colonies so as to cause them the greatest possible damage. The same instructions were given to Admiral Popov, commander of the Russian Asiatic fleet. The presence of the Russian Navy helped the Union enforce a devastating naval blockade against the southern states, which denied them access to critical supplies from Europe. It was not that these ships single-handedly kept the French and English vessels at bay. Actually, there is no record of them even firing upon each other, but that is the point. The fact that neither France nor England at that time wanted to risk becoming involved in an open war with the United States and Russia led them to be extremely cautious with overt military aid to the South. Throughout the entire conflict, they found it expedient to remain officially neutral. Without the inhibiting effect of the presence of the Russian fleet, the course of the war could have been significantly different. The beginning of the war did not go well for the North, and in the early years the outcome was far from certain. Not only did the Union Army face repeated defeats on the battlefield, but enthusiasm from the people at home was badly sagging. As mentioned previously, at the outset, this was not a popular war based on humanitarian principle. It was a war of business interests. That presented two serious problems for the North. The first was how to get people to fight, and the second was how to get them to pay. Both problems were solved by the simple expediency of violating the Constitution. The Emancipation Proclamation. To get people to fight, it was decided to convert the war into an anti-slavery crusade. The Emancipation Proclamation was primarily a move on the part of Lincoln to fan the dying embers of support for the rich man's war and the poor man's fight, as it was commonly called in the North. Furthermore, it was not an amendment to the Constitution, nor even an act of Congress. It was issued totally without constitutional authority, as the solitary order of Lincoln himself, acting as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. Preservation of the Union was not enough to fire men's enthusiasm for war. Only the higher issue of freedom could do that. To make the cause of freedom synonymous with the cause of the North, there was no alternative but to officially declare against slavery. After having emphasized over and over again that slavery was not the reason for war, Lincoln later explained why he changed his course and issued the proclamation. "Things had gone from bad to worse until I felt we had reached the end of our rope on the plan we were pursuing, that we had about played our last card and must change our tactics or lose the game. I now determined upon the adoption of the emancipation policy." The rhetoric of the proclamation was superb, but the concept left a great deal to be desired. Bruce Catton, writing in the American Heritage Pictorial History of the Civil War, explains, "Technically, the proclamation was almost absurd. It proclaimed freedom for all slaves in precisely those areas where the United States could not make its authority effective and allowed slavery to continue in slave states which remained under federal control. But in the end, it changed the whole character of the war and, more than any other single thing, doomed the Confederacy to defeat." The proclamation had a profound impact on the European powers as well. As long as the war had been viewed as an attempt on the part of a government to put down rebellion, there was nothing sacred about it, and there was no stigma attached to helping either side. But now that freedom was the apparent issue, no government in Europe, least of all England and France, dared to anger its own subjects by taking sides against a country that was trying to destroy slavery. After 1862, the chance that Europe would militarily intervene on behalf of the Confederacy rapidly faded to zero. On the propaganda front, the South had been maneuvered into a position which could not be defended in the modern world. Converting the war into an anti-slavery crusade was a brilliant move on Lincoln's part, and it resulted in a surge of voluntary recruits into the Union Army. But this did not last. Northerners may have disapproved of slavery in the South, but once the bloodletting began in earnest, their willingness to die for that conviction began to wane. At the beginning of the war, enlistments were for only 3 months, and when that period was over, many of the soldiers declined to renew. Lincoln faced the embarrassing reality that he soon would have no army to carry on the crusade. Raising armies on both sides. Historically, men are willing to take up arms to defend their families, their homes, and their country when threatened by a hostile foe. But the only way to get them to fight in a war in which they have no perceived personal interest is either to pay them large bonuses and bounties, or to force them to do so by conscription. It is not surprising, therefore, that both methods were employed to keep the Union Army in the field. Furthermore, although the Constitution specifies that only Congress can declare war and raise an army, Lincoln did so entirely on his own authority. The northern states were given an opportunity to fill a specified quota with volunteers before conscription began. To meet these quotas and to avoid the draft, every state, township, and county developed an elaborate bounty system. By 1864,